Hello, welcome once again to Leto's Law. I'm Steve Leto. So here to talk about the poor man's copyright. The poor man's copyright. And then at the end, I'll explain to you, I got a stack of books left over. I went to a little writer's thing, and I bought a case of books. I got a few left over. So if you want one of these from me, I'll tell you how to do that at the end of this video. But I did a video recently about the concept of when something becomes mail, and whether or not you can tamper with somebody else's mail and what that means. And somebody, and quite a few people actually, asked me about, you know, Steve, what about the poor man's copyright? The idea that if you wrote something, a book, a novel, a song, and you wanted to make sure that it was protected, but you didn't feel like going to all the trouble of filing with the copyright office in Washington, couldn't you just do what I've heard people say? And that is you type up a copy of what you've created, stick it in an envelope, and mail it to yourself. And then you just keep this unopened envelope laying around, and it's got a postmark on it, and you can use that postmark to prove when you created this. So that somewhere down the road, when somebody steals your creation, you can say, hey, wait a second, I got this postmarked envelope that can prove that I actually created this back in the day, therefore, you're gonna lose your claim when I sue you for violating my copyright. And it's one of those things that it has all the hallmarks of an urban legend, right? And as a lawyer, the first thought I have is, wait a second, you've got the sealed envelope, and inside of it is your draft of a movie screenplay. And somebody made this movie last year. And you come into my office and say, Steve, I want to sue the creators of this movie because they stole my screenplay. I can prove it. It's inside this envelope that's been sealed with a postmark on it. And I say, oh, show it to me. Oh, wait, we can't open the envelope. Because if we open the envelope, no one's going to believe us. But then on the other hand, am I going to take a case from somebody who's going to show me an envelope that we can't open? But hey, it's a winner. Look, just trust me, it's in there. So here's the thing. There's that obvious problem there, right? But there's other problems also. And so here's the thing. And I'll tell you right now, I was poking around the internet doing research on this. And I found a guy who beat me to this by about 13 years. And it's a great article written by a guy named Eric Goldman. And I'm going to put the link to his post in the description of this video because he lays it right out. Because the first thing he points out is he says, you know, if this is such a great idea, I wonder how the courts have handled it. By now, someone must have walked into court and said, Your Honor, I've got a poor man's copyright right here. And then the judge says, oh, let's all gather around and open it up, right? I mean, that must have happened, you'd think, somewhere. Not really. So he did a search in the various legal databases looking for the term poor man's copyright. And this is such a well-known phrase that would find you cases. And he actually found three. And they're all fairly recent, interestingly enough. And I would have thought that you'd find some older ones, but no, these are all from the 2000s. And in 2009, for instance, in New York State, there was a lawsuit involving a draft of a screenplay entitled The Inner Mind's Eye, which the author had mailed to himself. And then these people met, and the claimant and the other person brought in two sealed envelopes, one postmarked April 1995 and the other November 1996, allegedly documenting the poor man's copyright of Inner Mind's Eye and a Writers Guild registration of which the date was unclear. By the way, the Writers Guild, there's a process whereby they will accept filings and keep track of them so that you can prove that you filed something with the Writers Guild. But that's another thing altogether. The court in this case found that the Inner Mind's Eye bore the badges of fraud and the thumbprints of the infringer. Mr. Smith's alleged embedded signatures do not withstand scrutiny or are otherwise of no significance. His poor man's copyright was bogus. He altered a letter and inserted the reference, and his alleged early draft contains portions of a book written years after the alleged date of Mr. Smith's draft. So this guy tried to do a fake poor man's copyright, according to the court. In other words, the court found that, yeah, the guy had an envelope. It had a postmark on it. But there's things inside the envelope that didn't belong inside the envelope. And that's the problem. How do you prove this? You got to prove everything. You can't walk into court and go, hey, postmark, boom, I win. There's no rule that says postmark wins. I mean, it's a get out of jail free card. So they point out, in this case, the issues you have with simply proving what's in the envelope, when did it get in the envelope, and, you know, that. So a second case he found out of North Carolina from 2010 called Barefoot versus Goulian. According to Barefoot, Landis and Miller also had him placed in lockdown for security concerns when two witnesses, who were habitual liars, were in the compound yard together. But anyways, Barefoot utilized an envelope's poor man's copyright to copyright multiple gospel, country, and bluegrass songs. Barefoot claims that Miller and somebody else violated his rights to a speedy trial. Sounds like sovereign citizen stuff. But Barefoot claims that he has claims here is free speech, religion rights, but then there's an issue here with the poor man's copyright, and that, of course, the allegations were that someone tampered with the mail. And I trust me, I'm skipping over this, and I'm leaving out a lot of the verbs on purpose, because the portion that he yanked out of the case is quite convoluted, and it's clear that the man was probably crazy. But it boils down to the guy had an envelope, which he claimed contained things, and it appeared that there was tampering done with it. And that, of course, again, gets us back to the original problem. How do you prove what was in the envelope when you mailed it? And then finally, out of Minnesota, somebody began mailing research results to herself to produce a paper trail. And this is otherwise known as a poor man's copyright. But there's no reference being made to how effective that was. And so the man who wrote this column, Eric Goldman, said, as you can see, none of the cases actually discussed the legal efficacy of a poor man's copyright. The Smith case, which I think was the first one, discusses it, but ultimately sidesteps the question. And he says, but those are the only three cases he found that even discuss it at all. But as he points out, you could come into court with an envelope, postmarked, sealed, witnessed by God, okay? And let's assume that the judge buys it, the jury buys it, everyone says, yes, you have an envelope that is postmarked, and the contents of the envelope are correct and accurate, and they were there when the envelope was postmarked. And then when we open it up in court, assuming that's what we do, and we look at it and we go, oh my gosh, those pages are in fact what you say they are. They are your original creation, created at a date no later than that postmark. Okay, so it proves that you at one point in time created this stuff, put it in an envelope before this date, okay? Does that mean you're going to win your copyright claim? No. So first of all, as again, I'm giving full credit here to Eric Goldman, the Copyright Office itself says, quote, there is no provision in the copyright law regarding any such type of protection, and it is not a substitute for registration. So the Copyright Office itself says, poor man's copyright, it's just out there, but it's not something we recognize. And so then, here's the other problem. To establish copyright infringement, the author, the creator of the work, must show copying in fact and wrongful copying. And all the postmark does is show when you invented it. It doesn't, you know, when you created it, it doesn't say that, oh, by the way, this proves someone got a hold of your work and copied it. You still have to prove that. That's actually the more important element. Now, don't get me wrong. If I could prove beyond a shadow of doubt that I wrote a 75,000 word manuscript entitled American Murder Houses, that had 25 chapters in it about murder houses around the country, and it has a foreword where I discuss walking over and looking at one particular murder house on a sunny Saturday afternoon with my good friend John in 2013, and at the end there's a chapter about diminished value of murder homes when they go on the real estate market, and then there's an acknowledgement in the back that's very, very personal to me, and if I could do a poor man's copyright proof and show that I had actually written this book no later than 2015, okay? If you came along and published a book entitled American Murder Houses, and it had all those chapters and that acknowledgement and that forward and all that stuff, and it was obviously mine word for word, it wouldn't be hard to prove that you copied it. I mean, that seems pretty straightforward, right? And you might say, Steve, how'd they get a copy? They went to a bookstore and bought it. It's widely available. Okay. But the bigger issue instead is when someone says that they're copywriting a screenplay. And my screenplay involves a group of ragtag misfits who are playing some sport somewhere, but they're not very good. They're from the poor side of town. A couple of them don't appear to bathe. Their parents are poor. Some of them are orphans. And they somehow manage to get themselves into the league. And then they surprise everyone against all odds by winning games. And next thing you know, people are rooting for them. And the local town folk come out to support them. And then, of course, they get into the championship game against those rich, spoiled kids from the other side of town whose parents drive Rolls Royces and Lamborghinis and sip martinis and champagne while watching the games. And then the whole thing comes down to the final moments of the game. And then the smelliest, littlest kid on the team hobbles up and scores the goal, hits the home run, sinks the winning basket, or throws the winning jart. Okay, you poor man copyrighted that screenplay and sent it to yourself. And next thing you know, someone put out a movie that follows that plot. Obviously. Except that screenplays and movies bear some similarity to each other, but we all know that many movies bear similarities to each other. Many screenplays bear similarities to each other. And, you know, a friend of mine wrote a book called The Marsh King's Daughter. It came out a couple years ago. Fabulous book, sold very, very well. It's been translated into dozens of languages. You can buy it in Iceland, okay? And about a year ago, someone else published a book called Where the Crawdad Sings. And if you look at the most basic outline of those two books, they both involve young girls grown up in a swampy wetland area or a marsh and overcoming against all odds to thrive and survive. And there's some conflict with a father. Okay. And I've only read Marsh King Daughter. I've not read Where the Crawdad Sings. My brother has read them both. And he called me up and he goes, Steve, he goes, the craziest thing. He goes, Where the Crawdads Sing. He goes, the parallels are uncanny. But there's no question the two books were written simultaneously because Karen was working on her book for years. And the other woman who wrote Where the Crawdads Sing was writing her book for years also. And they're both writing their books at the same time. They don't know each other. It's just a coincidence. Sometimes that happens and that can happen. And my understanding is they're both fabulous books. I've only read Karen's book. I'm looking for it here. Hang on a second. Again, I should have thought to look for this before I started shooting the video. Anyways, it's back here somewhere. I have a galley copy because she thanked me in the acknowledgments. Oh, well, I'm sorry. I don't have it here. Just trust me. But again, no one's raised any allegations about that. Obviously, I'm merely raising the point that there are similarities in things like that that can happen. And you can imagine if somebody had written a book that had these elements in it, sent the poor man's copyright themselves, and then said, wait a second, someone published a book. They must, you know, you've still got to prove that they actually copied it and they did so wrongfully. So that's an element that you have to have. So the postmark has no relevance to the copying in fact or the wrongful copying. All it does is provide evidence that your work predates the other person's, and people can independently create things, and they both can copyright what they've created. Okay? So, as Eric Goldman writes, it's legally okay for two copyright authors to independently create the same work, and neither is infringing on the other in that situation, assuming that's true. So even if the plaintiff establishes authorship priority, the plaintiff is not any closer to winning the case. That's the least important thing is that, oh yeah, I made my thing here, you made your thing here. So what? And that's, you know, there are examples of things being created at the same time. Talk to Elisha Gray. Call him on the phone. And he points out that the plaintiff will need to show the defendant actually copied the plaintiff's work. And if the defendant doesn't admit copying and the plaintiff doesn't have actual evidence of copying, the plaintiff typically shows copying, in fact, circumstantially by showing the defendant had access to the work and the resulting work is suspiciously familiar, and then a similar, and then a jury could draw that conclusion. And the postmark has zero evidentiary value in showing the defendant had access to the work. In fact, so long as the work remains in the sealed envelope, we know that the defendant couldn't have copied that copy because it was in an envelope. So the plaintiff's obligation to show the defendant had access to the plaintiff's work before the defendant's creation effectively establishes the plaintiff's priority. So a postmark could help only if it undercuts the defendant's ability to argue independent creation, and only if the plaintiff's proof of access didn't otherwise address the issue. So he says anything could happen in litigation, but the odds of the postmark providing the dispositive evidence seems very, very remote. So, you know, that's the thing. The poor man's copyright, you know, I suppose all you're wasting by doing it is the cost of postage. If it makes you feel better, do it. But the odds of you walking into court one day, carrying this thing out like it's, you know, a holy document, and then everyone opening it and saying, oh, look at this, it's not going to happen. But, you know, like I said, the only cost to you is the cost of the postage and the envelope. So that's the poor man's copyright. Again, like I said, if you want to read the whole article and see those cases, I'll put the link in the description. And I mentioned before that I did attend a writer's thing a couple weeks ago, and I had a case of American Murder Houses. I've got a stack of them left. If you want one, cheaper than Amazon, I'll mail it to you. Send me an email with the either book or American Murder Houses in the subject line. And what I'll do is I will invoice you via Square at Secure like PayPal. $15, I think, is the price of the book. In fact, it is. If it's not, I'll change it. $15. That includes postage, and I will sign it to you and mail it to you. That's anywhere in the United States. Outside of the U.S., it's not really cost-effective mail. I apologize. But inside the United States, and like I said, I've got about 10, 12 copies left. So fire the note, emails my way if you want one. If not, questions or comments, put them below. Otherwise, talk to you later. Bye-bye.